Part 1. The Context. Welcome to the Animist Museum of Lake Texcoco. Before we enter, here is a brief context of the place which has prompted the creation of such kind of museum. Lake Texcoco, located on the eastern fringe of Mexico City, existed as a massive lagoon until its complete desiccation around 1971. It was the largest body of water in the entire Mexican central region by the time the Spanish conquistadors arrived in this part of the Americas. Around the 1500s, when it was still filled with water, Lake Texcoco lay on the very same place where Mexico City now stands, overflowing the northeastern side of the metropolis towards its outskirts, its shores reaching the neighboring city of Texcoco. Mexico City was founded in 1521 on the island of Tenochtitlan to exert and symbolize the dominance of Spain upon the new land. Colonial architecture was erected on top of indigenous temples and dwellings. Over the course of the coming centuries, and as the capital expanded, Lake Texcoco was also subjected to territorial dominance, being forcefully shrunk towards its northeastern margins. By 1971, the water was completely gone, leaving a vast, deserted terrain, which has become, ever since the basin's desiccation, a contested space in which constant disputes for governance, land, water, and development have been taking place. These disputes overlap and overflow with the exponential growth of Mexico City, one of the most densely populated cities in the world, resulting in numerous attempts to conquer a former lake which has now become a vast extension of exploitable land. The dynamics of power acting upon Lake Texcoco has turned every being into a thing. People, animals, plants, water, rocks, soil. This museum contains material traces of such reconquering attempts, constituting a collection of all sorts of materials, recovered artifacts from demolitions, broken pieces belonging to failed government projects, fragments of earthly strata which were dragged along with the land's transformation or extracted in violent movements, a red rock, a fragment of rubble belonging to a former city center building, a broken sheet of vinyl floor imitating the color of wood, a glass fragment clouded by salt stains, a hand-painted ceramic tile, a used plastic spoon, a broken toy car, a soda bottle with the face of a cartoon girl named Lulu stamped on its surface, an official document with its edges slightly torn. Part 2. The Animist Exhibition. The animist nature of the museum we are entering incites a particular kind of exhibition, allowing its pieces to remain, in a certain sense, untamed. Firstly, some of the objects gathered here have been produced too recently to be crystallized in a particular narrative of a distant past. They are also constantly transforming, shrinking as the humidity still leaves their porous surfaces, collapsing as their molecular structures rearrange. Contemporary materials are unpredictable, feeble, somehow wild. Consider the Anthropology Museum of Mexico City as a counterexample. As you walk through the rooms of a rock-solid monumental building, the past of the Mexican nation transparently unveils through a series of objects, all belonging to a long-gone era. Its well-settled antiquity provides a safe distance between object and viewer, thus setting a horizon to comfortably look at, a steady reference for our present's unsteadiness. The frozen state of large monoliths, totems, statues, and ritual objects in the Anthropology Museum is also likely to be accommodated at will. The anthropological relics will not physically twitch, shiver, or resist with their own lively forces when moved. They may be relocated to the corner of a room or placed at its center if any meaning needs to be produced as a result of the object's groupings and their correlations. The relics will just yield to manipulation, lying in their apparent passivity, becoming receptacles of the desired stories of power, conquest, or supremacy of a culture over another. The Mexica people, conveniently positioned at the central wing of the Anthropology Museum, become the ancestors worthy of identification. Instead, what we are now introducing is an animist museum. But what is an animist museum? Animism, born with a 19th century anthropology, originally named a series of practices and forms of knowledge which did not fit a colonial dualist worldview. The primitive, the divergent, the wild were considered to be animist because of their clamor for life and personhood of things inanimate. Understood through a decolonial lens, animism may exist as a force of resistance, identifying yet unacknowledged forms of life otherwise captured by an all-encompassing modernity. An animist museum may be the place where the living and the non-living trade their places. The animist museum may bypass those practices intending to interpret objects as signs of a unified, coherent, archaeological or anthropological mindset. Instead of separating objects in accordance with certain taxonomies, the animist museum seeks to blur the boundaries between viewers and objects. Rather than delineating a distance between objects and public, this museum brings its pieces closer to the viewer. Other than preserving historical relics, this is a museum in which change and decay are encouraged. As it was deprived of its water, Lake Texcoco collapsed into multiple fragments, which were irregularly mapped, opaquely adjudged, morphologically transformed beyond recognition. Its territory has become a series of uneven portions of land, all belonging to an irreconcilable whole. A chaotic entity in itself, the lake defies any two-dimensional cartography or compass, turning its surface ever more concave, constantly changing its boundaries and inner features. Its historical developments, ever since its desiccation, are also marked by the brokenness of its basin. This is how Lake Texcoco's recent past has been accounted for via incomplete or contradictory reports, fluctuating facts, and intermittent information. Visualize the entrance of a museum of brokenness and discontinuity. If you look at the facade of the building that is hosting the Animist Museum's displays, you may notice that there is no sign embedded anywhere on the walls, no visual reference pointing at its official setting. This museum does not have a fixed location. Its collection does not yet have a space within artistic or historical institutions. Instead, its exhibition is being produced in the space of storytelling. The Animist Museum's architecture is structured in language. Voice infuses language with vitality. In turn, language becomes embodied in a unique assemblage of organs, fluids, skin, and affects. It travels, opens, spreads, and finally vibrates as it reaches the listener. In this scenario, frames of proximity and conversational setups between humans and things can be created as they are uttered, and further recreated as they are heard. Enacted words are not make-believe. This narration, for instance, does not unfold in the manner of an abstract discourse, which would differ from the material reality of a gallery display. voice is real and solid. It is material, spatial, inhabitable. It can shape frames of audibility as much as it can build containers, places, rooms, buildings, landscapes. Spoken words also allow the possibility of giving voice to things, which in other circumstances might remain voiceless. Part 3. The Museum. Before entering, breathe again. When entering the gates located in front of you, which will close themselves right after crossing, you will notice that there is no threshold, but rather you will be immediately and abruptly thrown into an indeterminate space. We are now in a pitch dark room. There is no visual reference of its size, not a single ray of light filtering through a crack from a boarded up window or even a shiny exit sign suspended high up in a wall within the room. As you take one step forward, you might want to tread carefully, since there may be a firm wooden floor beneath your feet, as much as there could be a series of disjointed tiles which could make you trip and fall as you walk. The floor could even be made of bare earth, uneven, uncovered, and dusty. The architecture is not necessarily visible, nor is it yet reachable through touch. The space could be wide as a gallery or narrow as a corridor. The surfaces of the walls could be smooth or textured, colored or white. The ceiling may be high or low, flat or curved. Continuing with the tour, I now encourage you to start exploring the room, disregarding that there is nothing yet in sight at the moment, bearing in mind or even embracing your possible disorientation. Please walk carefully. As you take each step, try to awaken your other senses. Try listening to the sound of your own feet touching the floor. Try hearing the sound of the friction your own clothes might be making as you move forward. Try sensing your own heartbeat, your own breath. Try to understand the room in which this exhibition is hosted by reaching out with your hands to whatever is near you, abandoning any fear of knocking down an object to the ground. Try stepping firmly and without fear of falling. Please remain in this state of quiet, vigilant activity for a while. Let us imagine a map of the Valley of Mexico region where Lake Texcoco is located. This region was covered in water centuries ago. It is now a patchwork of irregularly urbanized colonies, morphing westward into the dense metropolis of Mexico City. Communal partitions of land spread throughout the east, and in the middle of it all, an intermediate space that is still called Lake Texcoco. The ejidos, originally communal partitions of land created in 1917 resulting from the Mexican Revolution, are currently intermingling with this former lake's terrains, forming a disordered border of rural properties and federal land, constantly shifting to this day. Within this buffer area called Lake Texcoco lies a highway, horizontally cutting through, allowing traffic to flow from Mexico City to the eastern neighbor city of Texcoco. In the southern hemisphere of this highway lake division lies Lake Nabor Carrillo, a rectangle-shaped artificial lagoon, resting amidst an equally artificial ecological reserve. North of the highway, Mexico City's new international airport is under construction, causing the whole region to tremble and slowly break apart. Unable to find our way back to the entrance, we understand that we have fully entered the space, as we have gained a clearer awareness of being surrounded by darkness in a room of indeterminate shape and size. As we can't see anything, we are listening and touching our way through, gaining an alternate perspective on what a museum could be without any devices delineating a path, without any lights shaping the contour of objects, without barriers separating us from a possible array of inanimate things. This space we are currently in could be filled with diverse things, as much as it could be filled with bodies. In fact, things and bodies could be regarded as equals within this state of indeterminacy that the Animist Museum is prompting us to embrace. In the dark of our own thoughts and fleshy sounds, we may feel like we are becoming things ourselves, just mere bodies in a room. Part 4. The Pieces. Let us now visualize the other elements around us. These elements may be other visitors, such as yourself, trying to find their way, accidentally colliding with one another, or just standing still. They might also be things with different molecular structures and incomprehensible behavior, vibrating in ways we can't yet perceive, moving subtly as they accommodate themselves in space, sending almost inaudible sound waves from afar. Such sound waves cutting through the air, bouncing against the walls in a cringe, a brushing sound, a tap. We begin noticing a group of rock-like materials near us, composed of hard, earthly structures confounded with debris from synthetic ingredients. Can debris hold the memory of a construction's life as well as the trauma of its demise? Mexico City's 1985 earthquake caused countless human deaths as the buildings in many neighborhoods completely collapsed. As a large part of the city rested on the muddy lakebed of Texcoco, seismic activity was amplified by the softness of the soil. The debris from the aftermath, piled up in mountains, was loaded in trucks and discarded on the remaining basin of Texcoco, which had already been confined to the metropolis's outskirts after being deprived of its water. A piece of concrete covered in dusty soil and salt would reveal itself years later. As we touch these hard materials from radically different origins, all gathering in the basin of a desiccated lake, we might become aware of the softness of the matter we are made from. Our skin is so thin it might tear when touching a sharp edge of a concrete block. Our organs work as an ensemble in fragile equilibrium, which any ingested foreign body, however small, might brutally break. Our brain is as soft as pudding, its synapses being impossibly thin threads that could come undone with the pitch of a loud noise. Our bones become porous and rigid in time, risking to crack our steadiest structure with a single fall to the ground. In turn, the feeble structure of the human body demands harder materials to remain alive. We need a roof over our heads, clothes on our bodies, tools in our hands, footwear, means of transportation. The materials surrounding us in this dark room we have declared as the Animist Museum of Lake Texcoco are, in a way, an extension of our bodies, a second nature created for our need to live. We discover other kinds of shapes and textures that might have been brought along with us in our pockets or bags. These are familiar objects made stranger by this Animist Museum. They might have been left behind on the salty lakebed of Lake Texcoco or on any other wasteland. A plastic cup, a brick, a broken piece of wooden slat, a square-shaped ceramic tile, an irregular portion of drywall, a glove, a set of rusty nails, a plastic Coca-Cola bottle, a rusty piece of spring, a PVC pipe. In 2014, as the eastern border of Lake Texcoco's terrains continued to expand, claiming ejido communal lands from its immediate neighbors, a community of thousands which had been dwelling on the basin's dry soil for a yet undetermined period of time had to suddenly abandon their homes, carrying but a few objects of survival, leaving other objects behind, amongst piles of rubble which may still be found on the former lagoon's arid surface. The way this lakebed has been partitioned over the past decades has led to various territorial claims ongoing to this day, which have caused the basin to change in unexpected ways. Precarious housing, the creation of an enormous landfill, rural properties in expansion, unfinished recreational projects, endeavors in public infrastructure, and a massive future airport are some of the human interventions which have been breaking this untaken land apart. In a few years' time, this museum could be one of the few collections of material evidence left from this land's complex layered realities. A number of endeavors in development and regeneration have been implemented on this desiccated lakebed, causing it to break apart in smaller, increasingly untraceable parts. As this land shows itself as a grouping of fragments, we are now implicated with its rocks, objects, and debris. Thus, we may possibly become a fragment among many of this lake. We are now confounded with this museum's collection as we have been blending with its objects. It has become clearer that our proximity to these objects is not incidental. As we have walked through this animist museum, inhabiting its indeterminate, unlit galleries delineated with words, we realize that the objects we have encountered are infused with a certain kind of life. In return, we might even be becoming museum pieces ourselves, a hybrid, walking and talking evidence of Lake Texcoco's existence.